This is May 4th, 2013, and today I'm going to read and comment on some recent writings about meditation, the benefits of meditation. Some of this, for many of you, this will, you don't need to hear this. You know the benefits of meditation. That's why I've been doing it so long. But for newer people, it may help them have a little more faith in what is to come with consistent, dedicated practice. You know, the whole area of brain research is coming out with all kinds of evidence supporting the pointing to the benefits of meditation. The one I'm going to start with is from the New York Times, an article called "The Power of Concentration" by a Maria Konnikova. She's an author of a book called "Mastermind: How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes," and she's a doctoral candidate in psychology at Columbia. As usual, I'll just be skipping around in this. She begins, "Meditation and mindfulness. The words conjure images of yoga retreats and Buddhist monks, but perhaps they should evoke a very different picture, a man in a deerstalker puffing away at a curved pipe, Mr. Sherlock Holmes himself. The world's greatest fictional detective is someone who knows the value of concentration, of throwing his brain out of action, as Dr. Watson puts it. He is the quintessential unitasker in a multitasking world." "More often than not, when a new case is presented, Holmes does nothing more than sit back in his leather chair, close his eyes, and put together his long-fingered hands in an attitude that begs silence. He may be the most inactive, active detective out there. His approach to thought captures the very thing that cognitive psychologists mean when they say mindfulness." I'm going to just comment on that definition of by cognitive psychologists of mindfulness in just a minute. "Though the concept originates in ancient Buddhist, Hindu, and Chinese traditions, when it comes to experimental psychology, mindfulness is less about spirituality and more about concentration, the ability to quiet your mind, focus your attention on the present, and dismiss any distractions that come your way." The formulation dates from the work of the psychologist Ellen Langer, who demonstrated in the 1970s that mindful thought could lead to improvements on measures of cognitive function and even vital functions in older adults. But let me back up here and and just point out that although cognitive psychologists might conflate the terms concentration and mindfulness, in Buddhist meditation, these are seen as two different things, although very much related, of course. They've often been compared to the two wings of a bird, that any real viable, true Buddhist meditation needs to have both these sides, side by side. The concentration, what we call concentration, is focusing the mind and holding it on a fixed point. So with a koan like mu, is just to be absorbed in mu so thoroughly that any distractions that come into the mind are not attended to. They're just ignored. They may be noticed, but we don't do anything, try to do anything about them, but we keep the attention riveted on this one point, which could also be the breath. So concentration is a gathering in and a focusing. Mindfulness, I would suggest, and others, other Buddhist teachers have, is more a matter of noticing. It's more of a broader awareness of things. There's much more that could be said about these distinctions, mindfulness, concentration, what we call in Zen no-mindedness, but that will take us too far afield now. Maybe in some Taisho in the not-distant future, I'll get into this in more detail, but here the author puts them all together, and that's all right in terms of an article about meditation for the layperson. I won't get bogged down in this distinction, but the other thing she says here is that mindful thought could lead to improvements on measures of cognitive function, even vital functions in older adults. Mindful thought in Zen is something of an oxymoron, although also not in another way. Roshi Kapler used to distinguish between thinking and thoughting, and I think it's a marvelous distinction to make. Thinking is not something that Zen has any quarrel with. We need to think, of course. We need to problem solve at times. We need to analyze at times. We need to bring forth the functioning of this tremendous human endowment we call the intellect or the discriminating mind, the discursive mind. We need to use that as human beings, and that has great value, especially concentrated thinking about a problem, for example, and a meditation practice, whatever, whether it's Zen or another kind of Buddhist meditation, this will strengthen our ability to think incisively with this intellect. Thoughting, however, there's no such word, but Roshi Kapler made it up, but maybe someone should put it in the dictionary. Thoughting is more just allowing, passively allowing the mind to run in every direction just as thoughts may pull it here and there. Thoughting is has no incisive, focused quality to it. It's just being at the mercy of the all the random, irrelevant thoughts that may file through the mind moment after moment. And that's seen in Zen Buddhist meditation as something that is harmful in terms of dimming our experience of reality and clouding the mind. It's just allowing our attention to be pulled hither and thither as it might. So mindful thought, okay, we could call that concentrated, incisive problem solving, which I think is what she's suggesting with Sherlock Holmes here. But in Zen meditation, we don't want to have anything to do with thoughts. That is formal meditation. There is a place for incisive thought, and if you have to do some problem solving, there's no better place to do it than on the mat, and there's no better posture to do that in than with your limbs gathered in toward the center of the body, the way we do, or way where everyone is sitting now in the Zendo. The word concentration means to bring together. And that's why we sit in these postures in our formal sitting, formal meditation, because when the body is integrated, brought together into the center, then this makes it easier for the mind to do the same thing, to come together and concentrate. So meditation, Zen meditation, can be used in this way to focus on a problem. And but the problem cannot be resolved through thought alone. Well, maybe some problems can, but really intractable problems. You know, should I marry this person or not, or should I take this job or should I turn it down, thought will take you only so far. Even incisive, concentrated thought will only take you so far. And then with a real resolution of the question comes by sinking underneath the thoughts, even concentrated thoughts, getting underneath them. And this is where the solution to a problem can reveal itself. She continues, now we're learning that the benefits may reach further still and be more attainable than Professor Langer could have then imagined. Even in small doses, mindfulness can effect impressive changes in how we feel and think, and it does so at a basic neural level. Let me go back to the word mindfulness. I think what she's doing, she's using this word to mean the conscious deployment of the mind, period. Just having awareness of where your mind is. Most people don't have, most of the time in their daily lives, they don't know what's going on in their mind. I'm convinced of this. They don't have self-awareness. They're so habitually grasping at sights and sounds and reacting to people and circumstances that they don't have the self-awareness of what's going on in the mind. And that's, let's consider that what this article is about. Self-awareness. That's really what mindfulness means in terms of this article. And in a way, that's what all meditation comes down to is awareness. In Zen, it takes two forms. There are two steps to formal Zen practice. The first, or not even formal, Zen practice in general, whether you're sitting or you're driving or you're walking or anything else, here are the two steps. The first is noticing what's going on in the mind, where your mind is. And the second is, once having noticed that, bringing it back to the practice one is working on. Or, which, when you're not sitting, when you're sweeping the floor or mowing the lawn or whatever, that means bringing it back to whatever it is you're doing, and getting it back into the present. The first step, the noticing where your mind is, that's the hard part, because you can't notice till you notice. You can be lost in thought for 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours. This is no exaggeration. Many people report this when they're early in practice, that they don't realize till 3 hours have passed that they even have a practice, that there's anything that they're involved in called meditation. So a lot of time can pass without any awareness of what's going on in the mind. Now, luckily, to do daily meditation will mean that you start to notice sooner, that those periods when you're just oblivious to what's going on in the mind, you don't know anything about where the mind is, those periods get shorter and you start to notice sooner when your mind has been wandering. But that's just sort of in the long term. At any given moment, you can't notice until you notice. And it's like waking up. It's like kind of a little awakening. Okay, my mind has been thinking about that person at work for the last half hour. So then you go to step two, which is bringing your mind out of those thoughts, which can be memories, can be thoughts of the past, they can be thoughts of the future, can be fantasies. bringing your mind out of those clouds back to just this. This right here. Now for people working on a koan, that means bringing it back to the koan. For people who are doing breath practice, then on the mat, when you're doing sitting, you bring it back to the breath. When you're not sitting or stationary, then it just means bringing your attention back to whatever it is you're doing. Washing the dishes. Working at your computer. Talking to someone in conversation. The mind, of course, wanders sometimes during conversation with people. As soon as you notice, just let those thoughts go. Just come back to this. That's mindfulness. Awareness. But then to repeat this sentence, even in small doses, mindfulness can effect impressive changes in how we feel and think. And it does so at a basic neural level. In 2011, researchers from the University of Wisconsin demonstrated that daily meditation-like thought could shift frontal brain activity toward a pattern that is associated with what cognitive scientists call positive, approach-oriented emotional states. States that make us more likely to engage the world rather than to withdraw from it. And then she describes the details of the experiment, which I have to skip over in the interest of time. But she concludes, as little as 5 minutes a day of intense Holmes-like inactivity and a happier outlook is yours for the taking. This is one of the many leads that have opened up in brain research, is how meditation, in addition to everything else, it brings greater emotional health, stability and flexibility, resilience. Happiness, in a word. But then she says, but mindfulness goes beyond improving emotional regulation. An exercise in mindfulness can also help with that plague of modern existence, multitasking. Of course, we would like to believe that our attention is infinite, but it isn't. Multitasking is a persistent myth. What we really do is shift our attention rapidly from task to task. Two bad things happen as a result. We don't devote as much attention to any one thing, and we sacrifice the quality of our attention. We don't devote as much attention to any one thing, and we sacrifice the quality of our attention. So if you're on the phone while you're balancing your checkbook, then you're not paying full attention to the person with whom you're talking on the phone, and you're not paying full attention to the balancing of the checkbook. Multitasking, let's face it, is so common. Who among us doesn't multitask at times? But I think it's very important to acknowledge the conclusions of the research that's being done, and more than a few studies that show that people who say, "Oh, I can multitask and I'm just fine doing two or three things at once," bullshit. It's not true. You think so. You'd like to think so. But it's not true. She says, when we are mindful, some of that attentional flightiness disappears as if of its own accord. And then I'll just describe very loosely this study they did at University of Washington. Examined the effects of meditation training on multitasking in a real-world setting. They asked some people to do engage in the type of simultaneous planning they did habitually. They were asked to complete several typical tasks and then send it, to complete those tasks by sending it by email or instant messages or so forth. After the multitasking free-for-all, participants were divided into three groups. One was assigned to an 8-week meditation course. Another group didn't take the course at first but took it later. And the last group took an 8-week course in body relaxation. Everyone was put through a second round of frenzy. So first there was the frenzied multitasking. Then there were the three groups, some of which did the meditation, others didn't, and then there was a second round of the multitasking. It said the only participants to show improvement were those who had received the mindfulness training. Not only did they report fewer negative emotions at the end of the assignment, there's that emotional component to meditation, but their ability to concentrate improved significantly. They could stay on task longer, and they switched between tasks less frequently. While the overall time they devoted to the assignment didn't differ much from that of other groups, they spent it more efficiently. She continues, the concentration benefits of mindfulness training aren't just behavioral, they're physical. This is where it gets really interesting in terms of the newest revelations in brain science. In recent years, mindfulness has been shown to improve connectivity inside our brain's attentional networks, as well as between attentional and medial frontal regions, changes that save us from distraction. Mindfulness, in other words, helps our attention networks communicate better and with fewer interruptions than they otherwise would. In a study at Emory University, increased meditation practice was associated with enhanced connectivity between the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, a part of the brain involved in attention monitoring and working memory, that on the one hand, and the right insula, an area that is associated with how well we monitor our own feelings and thoughts, and that is considered a key waypoint between our two major attention networks, the default and the executive. More on that in a minute. Not only could this increased connectivity make us better able to switch between tasks and monitor our own attention, but it is indicative of more effective overall management of our finite attentional resources. Mindfulness training has even been shown to affect the brain's default network, the network of connections that remains active when we are in a so-called resting state. With regular meditators exhibiting increased resting state functional connectivity and increased connectivity generally. After a dose of mindfulness, the default network has greater consistent access to information about our internal states and an enhanced ability to monitor the surrounding environment. These effects make sense. The core of mindfulness is the ability to pay attention. Attention. There's this Zen story most of you have probably heard, where a man comes to a Zen master in China, ancient China, and he says, please, can you give me some maxims of the highest truth? And the master dipped his brush in a pot of ink, and he wrote the character for attention. And the visitor said, thank you. He bowed and said, but could you say something more? And the master dipped his brush in the ink, and this time twice wrote, attention, attention. And now the visitor said, yeah, I get it, but can't you say something more? And then now you know what's coming. The master dipped his ink, and this time three times, attention, attention, attention. And now the visitor is getting irritated, and he said, "Oh, what does that word mean anyway?" And the master said, "Attention means attention." Attention, you know, you can, these things have different definitions. I bet you'd find half a dozen if you looked in the, or a dozen if you looked in the dictionary, what attention means. Of course, it's closely related to awareness. But there are broadly two kinds of awareness. There is the flashlight kind of focused awareness, where you direct, it's a directed awareness. That's one kind of attention, where you're directing your attention to something in particular, consciously directing it. And the other is more like a lantern, lamp awareness, which is not directed so much as just open on all sides, receptive, not directed, but receptive. And there is some loose correspondence between these two and what we were talking about earlier, concentration and mindfulness. Of course, the flashlight awareness, the directed attention, is the concentration, and the lantern awareness is more than the broader mindfulness or noticing or awareness. The thing you learn, if you keep sitting long enough, is that we do have a choice in how we direct our attention. And you also learn that our whole experience of reality rests on our ability to make that choice consciously and for our own good and that of others. So, for example, something is nagging at you, something you can't really do anything about. Maybe it's something that someone said to you in the past, something unpleasant. And you have a choice of chewing on that memory or directing your attention back to this, right here. Not the past, not the future. We have a choice in how to direct our attention. We discover this every time we sit and we notice that thoughts are invading the mind or have taken over the mind. Okay, we can either linger in those thoughts or we can just swing our attention back to the breath or the koan or whatever our practice is. That's it. First noticing the thoughts, then bringing the mind back. It may take a long time before we discover how easy this can be. It may take years of finding these thoughts so sticky, so enticing, so adhesive. That's how they may seem for a long time, and it's so hard for us to pull the mind free of the thoughts and get it back to the practice. But eventually we come to see that it really doesn't need to be that difficult. And what makes the difference? How does it get easier? Well, we learn that trafficking in thoughts may have some provisional value to it, but in terms of big issues, big things, those thoughts, that thoughting is useless. And we learn that eventually, and then the thoughts lose their allure. We don't want to be in this gray world of thoughts. we see them as more and more unsavory or something that's just, it isn't real. It's just dust in the mind. Who wants to keep dwelling in that dusty realm of thoughts? And then we learn how easy it is to just swing the mind back. It's just like a flashlight. How hard is it when you notice that the flashlight, the beam, you're in a dark room, the beam of the flashlight has wandered up to the ceiling. How hard is it to just flick it back to what's in front of you? That's a perfect analogy for how easy it can become. There's the analogy of clouds, thoughts as clouds. Through long practice, when we come to see this blue sky behind the clouds or within the clouds, when they break open a little bit and we see that blue sky, then we want to go back to that realm of no thought, of clarity and brightness and purity, which is what is everything in the mind beyond thought. Going back to this, where she says, the author here says, that the concentration benefits of mindfulness training aren't just behavioral, they're physical. Mindfulness has been shown to improve connectivity inside our brain's attentional networks. Just a little bit more about that. I'm switching to a Scientific American article from last year, April of last year, called Spine Tuning, Finding Physical Evidence of How Practice Rewires the Brain. And this is by a Ferris Jaber, I would say, Jaber, J-A-B-R. It looks like a European name, but that's why I say Jaber. But he's reporting on research presented in Nature magazine. I'll just read some of it. He starts out, I guess it's a he, Ferris. In kindergarten, several of my friends and I were very serious about learning to tie our shoes. I remember sitting on the edge of the playground, looping laces into bunny ears and twisting them into a knot over and over again until I had it just right. A few years later, whistling became my new challenge. On the car ride to school or walking between classes, I puckered my lips and blew, shifting my tongue like a rudder to direct the air. Finally, after weeks of nothing but tuneless whooshing, I whistled my first note. Although I had no inkling of it at the time, my persistence rewired my brain. This is so wonderful to hear. My persistence rewired my brain. Just about everything we do modifies connections between brain cells. Learning and memory are dependent on this flexibility. When we improve a skill through practice, we strengthen connections between neurons involved in that skill. In a recent study, scientists peeked into the brains of living mice as the rodents learned some new tricks. Mice who repeated the same task day after day grew more clusters of mushroom-like appendages on their neurons than mice who divided their attention among different tasks. In essence, the scientists observed in the brain a physical trace of practice. And then he describes the study, looked at three groups of mice that learned different kinds of behavior, and a fourth group that went about business as usual, learning nothing new. And then, not to get into the details here, but the conclusion was that the dendritic spines, dendritic as in dendrites, something in the brain, are highly dynamic, springing up or disappearing to strengthen or weaken the connections between neurons. Both the mice that learned new tricks and those that went about business as usual grew new spines on their neurons, but mice that were learning something grew far more clusters of spines made of two or more neighboring offshoots. Mice that repeatedly practiced reaching for a seed during the first 4-day period grew more clusters of dendritic spines than the mice who practiced two different tasks or those that played in the variously equipped cages. Further, spines that grew in clusters had a much higher chance of surviving, even 4 months later, than new spines that appeared on their own. Then the scientist who did this work, by the name of Yi Zuo, I think it is a very active process, Zuo says. The neurons work very hard to form clusters, to place spines close to one another. Even after a short training period on the first day, a mouse makes a lot of new spines. They might make double what they make in an ordinary day, but these spines are not clustered. Only after repeated training are they clustered. So, of course, what this all points to in terms of Zen practice is the need to practice regularly, repeatedly, persistently. That's how we get better at things. I'm going to skip to a third article now and just read a couple of paragraphs. This is from some 10 years ago in the New Yorker. I think I did a Taisho on this article called The Learning Curve. And it's by this Atul Gawande, who writes, he's a physician, surgeon, who writes, has written quite a few articles in the New Yorker. The subtitle of this is, like everyone else, surgeons need practice. That's where you come in. but I'm just going to focus on just these two paragraphs. Professors say that every 2 or 3 years they'll see someone truly gifted come through a program, someone who picks up complex manual skills unusually quickly, sees tissue planes before others do, anticipates trouble before it happens. Nonetheless, attending surgeons say that what's most important to them is finding people who are conscientious, industrious, and boneheaded enough to keep at practicing this one difficult thing day and night for years on end. As a former residency director put it to me, given a choice between a PhD who had cloned a gene and a sculptor, he'd pick the PhD every time. Sure, he said, he'd bet on the sculptors being more physically talented, but he'd bet on the PhDs being less flaky. And in the end, that matters more. Skill, surgeons believe, can be taught. Tenacity cannot. It's an odd approach to recruitment, but it continues all the way up the ranks, even in top surgery departments. They start with minions with no experience in surgery, spend years training them, and then take most of their faculty from these same homegrown ranks. I'm reminded of something that the late Shunryu Suzuki Roshi said, reportedly. He was the founder and first abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, who died many years ago, maybe 30 years ago. And he once said, you know, the only reason, the only way I became a teacher is that everyone else left. I just stayed. Now, you got to figure that some of this is Japanese self-effacement. It's just part of their socialization process that you always downplay your abilities. But there is something to it. Just the sheer persistence will bring forth results. Calvin Coolidge, of all people, said the following: nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. This is terrific advice in Zen practice. Then this Atul Gawande, in this article about surgeons, he continues, and it works. There have now been many studies of elite performers, concert violinists, chess grandmasters, professional ice skaters, mathematicians, and so forth, and the biggest difference researchers find between them and lesser performers is the amount of deliberate practice they've accumulated. Indeed, the most important talent may be the talent for practice itself. That is a talent, that determination, that perseverance to stick to it, that stick-to-itiveness in the face of resistance, a feeling of wanting to do anything but that. And he cites a K. Anders Ericsson, a cognitive psychologist and an expert on performance, notes that the most important role that innate factors play may be in a person's willingness to engage in sustained training. He has found, for example, that top performers dislike practicing just as much as others do. And then in parentheses says, that's why, for example, athletes and musicians usually quit practicing when they retire. And then he says, but more than others, they have the will to keep at it anyway. You reach a real turning point in practice when you might find yourself saying, you know, I'm not very good at this, but I'm going to keep doing it anyway. Better yet is skip the first judgment. You don't really need that. But if you feel you're pretty mediocre, that's all right. Just keep doing it. And then he talks about how he had his own his own little epiphany where he did this difficult surgical procedure. He finally, everything came together and he did it just right. And he says, I still have no idea what I did differently that day. But from then on, my lines went in. That's the funny thing about practice. For days and days, you make out only the fragments of what to do. And then one day, you've got the whole thing. Conscious learning becomes unconscious knowledge, and you cannot say precisely how. Of course, this whole process is accelerated. This coming together of ability is accelerated the more sitting you do. That's why people who understand this are drawn to sesshin, these intensive seclusions where we sit for 10 or more hours a day. That's where so much of the consolidation of practice, that's where more people than any other time report that they finally get it. It comes together and they acquire this faith in the efficacy of the practice, and that's enough to keep them going for forever. Can I see your watch? And then back to this original article about the power of concentration in the New York Times. The difference between a Holmes and a Watson is essentially one of practice. Attention is finite, it's true, but it is also trainable. Through modifying our practices of thought toward a more Holmes-like concentration, we can build up neural real estate that is better able to deal with the variegated demands of the endlessly multitasking, infinitely connected modern world. And even if we've never attempted mindfulness in the past, we might be surprised at how quickly the benefits become noticeable. And here's good news for many of us. Until recently, our 20s were considered the point when our brain's wiring was basically complete. But new evidence suggests that not only can we learn into old age, but the structure of our brains can continue to change and develop. In 2006, a team of psychologists demonstrated that the neural activation patterns of older adults began to resemble those of much younger subjects after just 5 one-hour training sessions on a task of attentional control. Their brains became more efficient at coordinating multiple tasks, and the benefit transferred to untrained activities. Similar changes have been observed in the default network, that is, the brain's resting state activity. In 2012, researchers from Ohio State University demonstrated that older adults who scored higher on mindfulness scales had increased connectivity in their default networks, especially in two of the brain's major information processing hubs. And while we already know that this kind of increased connectivity is a very good thing, there's more to these particular results. The precise areas that show increased connectivity with mindfulness are also shown to be pathophysiological sites of Alzheimer's disease. And she concludes, the implications are tantalizing. Mindfulness may have a prophylactic effect. It can strengthen the areas that are most susceptible to cognitive decline. Just one last thing before we end is this changing of our neural pathways, these brain changes. The traditional word for this is changing our karma. Karma literally means action. The word karma means action, or more broadly, action and reaction. But a kind of a working definition, a way to understand it in a practical, everyday sense, is it's habit energy. It's the brain circuitry that just gets laid down and just gets into more and more grooves. And so our meditation, not just sitting, but our awareness, our mindfulness in terms of our daily life, this is what helps change the brain, and with it our habit energy that we call karma, all those nuisance habits that we know that we can overcome, can change. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.